Hello and welcome to the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast, where we explore the fields, kitchens, and stories that make the Massachusetts food scene so special. I'm your host, Nissa Gadbois. Each week, we'll connect with farmers, food producers, and the community that makes the Commonwealth's food scene so vibrant. Join me as we meet the passionate farmers, food producers, and chefs who are shaping the farm-to-table movement right here in Massachusetts. Hello, and welcome back to the Massachusetts Farm-to-Table podcast. This is part one of a two-part podcast where I sit down with Lindsay Baird of Oak and Ash Farm in Belchertown, where she and her family farm 7.5 acres using regenerative practices. They have a market garden, pick your own flowers and herbs, and they raise pasture poultry for meat and eggs. I hope you'll enjoy this episode and come back next week to listen to part two of my podcast with Lindsay Baird. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Can you start by telling us a little bit about your farm and how you get started?
Sure. So my husband, Matt, and I started our farm about 10 years ago. We were looking for a place to build a house, but we really wanted to have a farm as well. So we found our property. It's about 7.5 acres. And when we bought it, it was entirely forested. So we didn't really know what to do. So we kind of cleared just what we needed for a house. And then my husband read the Holistic Orchard book and started to put in some orchard trees. So we have a mixed orchard. That's the oldest thing on the farm. And originally we were trying to figure out what can we do that would, you know, kind of go off of that idea. And we decided we wanted to open a craft distillery. So we took a course and learned as much as we could about it. And we're all set to open a craft distillery. And then the town was not okay with that. Just the way we were zoned, it wasn't going to work out. So we were a little dejected and not really sure what to do. We were collecting maple sap and doing maple syrup. But we really wanted to have a farm, but we didn't want to sort of clear cut our property. So my husband came across no dig gardening. And then through that, he learned about regenerative agriculture. And then once we got on that, it was like full steam ahead. So we have a 3/4 of an acre is market garden, which we do a small scale CSA. And then this year is the first year I'll be running a market. I'll be doing a farmer's market out of it. But the rest of it, we really didn't want to clear cut it. So we manage it as forest. We still do our maple syrup. But we have this rule where anywhere we clear trees, we replace it with new trees or other permaculture things. So most of our trees that we've cleared beyond our market garden, we're on a north slope too, which makes it very hard to grow things. So our market garden is tiered to sort of slow water from running off the property. But anywhere we've cleared trees, we've replaced it with polyculture tree rows. And then in between, we have pasture, and that's where we run our meat birds. And we've allowed them to sort of build their own pasture. So we really just like cleared the trees, ground the stumps down, let them run through it, and then just spread seed beyond them. So we just have this focus of, you know, trying to do the right things for nature. So if we're going to clear something, let's replace it with food for people and animals, creating habitat. And, you know, we're both nerds sort of to begin with. So we really have a focus on like, we're trying to learn as much as we can. And then we're really passionate about sharing that with other people. And we're trying to sort of prove this model of, you can produce a lot of food. You can have these really, really prolific small scale food systems that are also regenerative, and you can feed a lot of people and animals in a small space.
So do you, either of you have a farming background, or are you first generation?
We are first generation. I mean, we have sort of a homesteading background, I would say, more than anything. I have more of a farming background than my husband. I grew up on a large piece of property. We didn't keep animals of any kind, but we always had a very large garden. My dad was Italian, and like that was always very big in his family. And so we had this huge garden. And I literally, from the time I was can remember, I just loved it. Like I loved being able to go out and pick strawberries and pick asparagus in the springtime. And by the time I was about 10 or 11, I had researched and put in my first herb garden. And then by the time I was maybe 15, I had taken over the garden full time, like the full production of the garden. So I would, you know, was very into the planning of it and the planting. And then I also worked at Davis Farmland, which is in Sterling and where I grew up. And I got a lot of experience with animals there, which is where I said I would never have animals. But I've learned, yeah, exactly. As a farmer and as a parent, I've learned you don't ever say never, because here I am like, I could probably do some sheep and some cows, you know, all these things. But and then my husband, he grew up, he's a very short distance back from Ireland and his mother's side. And his family came over during the potato famine and settled in Down East Maine. And they had a massive blueberry farm. And over the generations, they sort of trickled down to Massachusetts. But his grandmother has a camp up in Maine, and she's since passed, but he used to spend every summer there with her and really learned to like eat off of the land. He did a lot of hunting and fishing and, you know, foraging for a lot of things. And his paternal grandparents always had a massive garden with lots of canning things. So that really sort of shaped what we wanted. Like from the beginning, we just sort of wanted like this Willy Wonka experience of being able to like walk out into the yard and just pick things. And we're getting pretty close to that at this point, but that's the background we came from. And it's me, I'm more, I wanted to be a chef. So I've always been very driven by food. I wrote a cookbook. It is not published yet, which is another story. But my passion is food. So much of, yes, I'm, again, now I'm more looking at it from a regenerative standpoint, but it always centers from this just like absolute love of eating really good food, like food that I just picked and I'm turning it into a dish. Like everything comes from that.
Yeah, it's incredible. Can't remember which one of the guests that was on recently, we were talking about the nutrient density. Mm-hmm. Of food that's just been picked in ground that's really healthy tastes completely different than something that's grown elsewhere and maybe was picked 5 days ago, 7 days ago, shipped on a truck. And even now people are surprised when they taste, if they come to the farm and they taste a tomato,
yep,
that was picked this morning, as opposed to something they bought in the store. And they're, why does that taste so different? It's because it still has a lot of its nutrients. It loses them so fast.
Yeah. But
really good, real food that you just harvested, it's the best thing. Just so good.
It is. And I think having grown up that way influenced a lot of that, because, you know, if you grow up that way and you're used to real food, and then you sort of go out into the world and you're buying food from a grocery store and you're going, what is this? And I get to the point now where, like, I always say my children are so spoiled and they don't really know how spoiled they are, because everything they eat is so, I mean, especially now that I have children, it's not as much, I don't care about me anymore. It's like their kids get all the fruit. They get all the things, because my focus is of course going to be on them. And I want everything that they eat to be as healthy as possible and to be as nutrient dense as possible. And you know, eating seasonally, and my kids are obsessed with peas, and I'm buying peas from a grocery store in like February, and I will taste them and they taste almost moldy to me. Mm. They don't taste like real food. It tastes like fake food. And I do notice that things that they'll eat sort of out of the garden, they won't necessarily eat, you know, the rest of the season. So we really try to focus on eating fresh and then and doing our preservation, because it's just such a different experience.
It is a different experience. I'm going to out one of my sons-in-law right now. Sorry, Paul. But when he didn't grow up eating fresh foods and things like that at the level that we do here. And he thought he didn't like vegetables. And then he was here, and the when you mentioned peas, it reminded me of this particular experience. We had just picked bucket loads of peas, and we pulled one of the 5-gallon buckets into the house, and we were going to start dividing it up to preserve it so we could have it for later. My son-in-law took one. He's like, oh, that's good. And another and another. And then he snuck out a whole bunch of them to take home. And my daughter was like, Mom, he walked and filled his shirt with peas, and he drove home. I don't know if he had them still in his shirt or if he had put them in a container or what he did, but he loved them so much. It was such a great experience for him. But I was, you can't be mad, right?
No.
It's
you're,
awesome.
You're like, hey,
good.
Yeah, welcome to real food. It's very different, isn't it?
It's very different. We noticed too that meat was very different when we raised those animals ourselves. I remember the first batch of pork that came back from the processor, and it wasn't pink. It was not pink meat. I'm looking at my husband. I'm looking at these packages, and I'm like, that's what raising them on dirt and grass and roots and things does, is so rich and so different. So the whole farming experience has blown my mind. We're first generation too. So
so we do meat birds, and this will be our third year. And there's no other way to describe them. And I can talk a little bit more about this, because we've really sort of gotten it down with the meat birds. And I'm very passionate about the way we do it. And I'm very happy to share that knowledge with other people, but when you taste them, there is like a succulence to it. You can overcook that chicken and it will still be so succulent and moist, and it just tastes like real food. And I do find a lot of our customers that are the most appreciative of the way that we do things, particularly for the taste, come from Europe. We have this man who did our CSA, and he is from Italy originally. And we gave him our first batch of strawberries, and he just took a bite and closed his eyes and went, I remember when strawberries used to taste like this. And he says, I won't buy them from the grocery store because, you know, where I grew up in Italy, this is what a strawberry tastes like. You know, it was probably still warm from the sun. Mm-hmm. And same thing, you know, you have people from other countries who want chicken to taste like chicken. And even though we're raising a Cornish cross, which is your traditional sort of like big breasted chicken, the way we're raising them, where they're out on pasture and they're healthy and they're fit, they literally like can run after, you know, their food. And it gets to the point where we're pouring food on the ground and they don't even care about that. They just want to go forage for, you know, they're excited because they're on a new set of grass and there's new bugs there and there's new things for them to eat. And it shows in the food. So, you know, our sort of motto is like, if we're going to raise an animal to sustain ourselves, I want that animal to have the best life possible. And I want it to have one bad day. And I don't even want it to know that it happened. I just want it to be as quick and painless and like that should be, you know, that makes me feel better about eating it because I definitely want to eat it. It's definitely much better.
Yeah.
You know, and nothing goes to waste and all of that, you know, we use every bit of it. So it's the taste, again, once you get sort of used to it, it's kind of like you get hooked on it and you can't really go back to eating food that doesn't taste like food.
So yes. You're new to Belchertown. How have you found the community in terms of supporting your work?
As a whole, incredibly supportive. I've learned a lot of hard lessons in the process, that, you know, food and farming is very tied to politics, whether you want it to be or not. And a farm is a small business, and that is also tied to politics. But Belchertown, as I understand it, over the last decade plus, since we have ourselves been part of this wave, has been this wave of just new buildings and lots of young families coming in. And they are hungry, literally, pun intended, for really good local food, local businesses. They want it. But Belchertown is one, a massive land area. It's the largest landmass town in the Commonwealth, if I'm saying that correctly. So it's huge. And you do have primarily a lot of farms. What comes with that is people who have, and I'm trying to be as understanding about this as possible. You have a lot of people who are multi-generations on their farm, and they are not always understanding or sympathetic to the cost prohibition of starting a new farm. Mm-hmm. And they're not always welcoming and eager to have you come in, and they will sort of look down on you. You know, again, I'm 7.5 acres and I'm farming less than that. I'm still producing a lot of things, but I'm working on a very small scale because that's what's achievable. And they look down on me because I'm not some monoculture farm with a giant tractor. I also am not working off of land that was given to me. I had to purchase this land and turn it into a farm. And that is a massive, massive undertaking. I mean, my husband and I say all the time that if we knew we were going to do this kind of farming, we wouldn't have bought a forested piece of land. We would have looked for a piece of cleared land that had been sort of degraded over time and tried to regenerate that, because that just makes a lot of sense. Again, we're still proving the model, but we made our work 10 times harder. So the old school farmers don't really get it. And I understand that. They are going off of sort of the model that they grew up with, and they just think that that is how farming goes. But I had a really interesting conversation with an older gentleman from American Farmland Trust, and he made a really good point. He said, well, you call it a regenerative farm where I'm from, that's just old school farming. So he's like, you're really doing actually more traditional farms, because a traditional farm had a great symbiotic relationship between the animals and the orchards and the fields. Everything worked together. Nothing got wasted. And you worked a little more in conjunction with nature on a smaller scale. No, you weren't farming 100 acres. You were farming something that was more manageable for one or, you know, a small family to maintain. So I thought that was a really good point. So we actually have if we can remind sort of the older generation that actually we're farming really close to what your great grandparents probably were doing, you know, I think it helps a little bit. But I've also been able to find a really amazing network of other small farmers. A lot of them are also female farmers. Mm-hmm. And I've really fostered those relationships, and I cherish them because, you know, we're all doing different things and we're all just trying to do our best. And, you know, we all farm a little differently, and that's okay. But we're there to support each other and kind of, you know, help each other out, because it's a lot. It's a lot of work.
Your experience with support from other farmers sounds like it's been very mixed.
Yes.
Yeah. So I agree. Having other farmers who share your vision is super important for being able to continue. Is there a group that you know of that, like a formalized group that you know of, or are these just other farmers you happen to meet?
These are just other farmers I happen to meet. I'm one of those people. I've always been very creative and I work better with other people. I need other people to bounce ideas off of. I thrive on a community of people who are I want the discussion. I don't want to just bury my head in the sand and say, this is just how I'm going to do this, and to hell with anybody else's opinion about it. Sometimes I can be a little bit like that, but I want the engagement of other people, because you can never really learn and grow and expand if you're not taking it in. So when I worked at a corporate job many years ago, I was on the Chamber of Commerce in town, or in the city, I should say. I was in Worcester, and I learned that, reaching out to the other small businesses is such a great way to just help each other. It's amazing how, just reaching out, because sometimes even people might think like, oh, they're my competition. And then if you reach out and have a conversation with them and you go, oh, actually, we're not competition. We're in this together. It's us against, large corporations. So what can we do to support each other? Whether it's, hey, what are we charging prices for this product or that product? Or, if you're going to do this, then I'll do this, and kind of staying out of each other's territory. I sort of reached out and found these other farmers. I will give to give a little shout out, Jen Turner, who is the head of our select board in town. I call her the great connector, because literally, this woman is constantly seeking what she can do to help improve the town, help improve the small businesses in town. And she's just meeting people all the time. So always at some point during a conversation, you'll hear from her, you know who you should meet. And so that is actually how I met most of these women. So I reached out to them, but Jen often connected me to a lot of them, which is, it's so great to have that person in town who's really seeking to connect everybody so we can work together.
Yeah, that's a real gift. Wow. Wow. That's super. So you mentioned permaculture and regenerative ag. So how did you all come to that path?
Slowly.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things we're sort of looking at again now, because we didn't know we were going to be on the regenerative ag path when we started. And if we did, we would have done things very differently. So we're doing a lot of, well, we wouldn't have done that if we had known we were going to do this later, like undoing a lot of hard work we've already done. But it started with, again, like my husband has a full-time job, which is frustrating, but also important. It allows us the freedom to take big leaps and say, okay, we're gonna spend the money to put this thing in, because we're not completely dependent on, the income of that I'm making off of the farm. But he started with reading The Holistic Orchard and was just very interested in that. He's a hunter. He's, again, spent so much time in nature, and he really helped me sort of understand hunters in a different way. But he's seen nature in a way that I've never seen it and experienced it, because, sitting in a tree stand for hours and hours and hours, he observes, he takes it all in. And so he also, again, is very interested in educating himself. We call ourselves, like, we're great collectors of knowledge but and skills. Like, we're always trying to add on another thing. So it started with the orchard, and then he found Charles Dowding, which is probably familiar to a lot of people on YouTube, No Dig Gardening. And then he wanted to learn more about regenerative farming. And so it kind of just was like a trickle effect. And then once he pulled me in, I was like, absolutely. So now it's gotten to the point where he does like, he has a bigger general view of like what we're doing on the farm. From he's doing, practicing interesting things with pollarding and coppicing trees as a form of orchard management. He wants to see if you pollard a maple tree, can you get it to grow bigger quicker so that you can produce maple syrup? You know, can you, we do lots of wattle fences around here. So we're combining all these different like methods and testing them out, but it now has taken it where I can look at an area and say, okay, let's look at what's going on in nature around it. Take our cues from that. What's growing already? What does this want to be?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we make that, how do we work with that concept and make it better where we can produce more food, again, either for ourselves or for wildlife? And how can we improve upon it? So we just kind of take that. And once you get the basics of like the regenerative principles down, it's so easy to just immediately apply it to an area. You know, you're observing, you're taking it in, and then you're saying, okay, how can I make this that much better, but still, you know, still keeping nature in mind and improving the soil in the process. So we've put in a lot of our tree rows, our polyculture tree rows. They're mixes of like wild plums, and we've got our nitrogen fixers and berries. We had a lot of berries growing on the property when we came here. So we just said, okay, well, we're really good at growing berries already. Part of why we bought this property was there were wild blueberries growing on the property already. So since we have moved here and cleared land and given it a little more light, and also brought in things like aronia berries, our native pollinator population has exploded. And because of that, our berry production has exploded because there's so many more native bees. We have tons and tons and tons of mason bees and big giant fat bumblebees. Mm-hmm. And they are working their little tushies off during orchard. They're just everywhere. My Blue Orchard mason bees have become my favorite thing in the world. They are so cute and they're very docile and they're very shy. If you go too close, they'll like hide. Aww. But they're amazing little workers, and it is amazing because we have thousands of them and there are bees. They don't have the range of a honeybee. They can only go so far. So those are our bees. And we have allowed that population to just explode because there's just so much here for them to eat. So it's been really amazing to watch that happen. Yeah. That's been like my favorite side effect, so to speak, of doing farming the way we're doing it is seeing how it's benefited the native population.
This episode of the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast is brought to you by Renaissance Farms Permaculture and the shop at Renaissance Farms. Please visit them online, and while you're there, sign up for the weekly newsletter and get 15% off your next order from the shop. Each edition of the newsletter includes farm news, articles, recipes, and updates on upcoming classes, courses, workshops, and special events. Subscribers also receive exclusive subscriber-only discounts each week. Links are in the show notes. Thank you for joining us on another delicious journey through the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to follow us on social media and join our Facebook group where you can join the local farm-to-table movement. Links are in the show notes. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future guests, we'd love to hear from you. Please drop us a line at massachusettsfarmtotable@gmail.com.
Until next time, remember to eat local, support your farmers, and keep the farm-to-table movement moving. Thanks for listening.